Hi, this is Greg Bresnitz, one half the host of Snacky Tunes. We have had the honor of being nominated by Taste Awards for Best Radio Show and Best Podcast. Please head to bit.do/stvote in order to vote for Snacky Tunes and other food favorites. Once again, that's bit.do/stvote. And a big congratulations to Heritage Radio Network for being nominated into the Hall of Fame. Thanks so much. We really appreciate it.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth, Wisconsin, makers of the world's best cheese and pioneers in the U.S. artisan cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We talk about food. Talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next L train is now arriving on the Manhattan-bound track. Please stand away from the platform edge.
welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz, sitting in what seems to be real close to Checkpoint Charlie with Billy Wagner of Noble Heart and Schmutzig. Thanks for joining, and thanks for being on the show.
Hi.
Hi. I want to start with the cast, which I think is a really interesting way for you to present all the people involved. It's really kind of called out on there. How did the cast come together, and how did you form as a group or ensemble, if you will?
We are a very small restaurant. We have like 28 seats around the bar. We have one big table with 14 seats, and it's like maybe sitting in a theater, and the kitchen is the stage, and so the person who was translating our German into English, she said it would be a good way to call it the cast, because you are all the actors somehow, and you're going to make the show for the guests at the end of the day. And we are like right now 8 people in the restaurant. One is a steward. We have 4 chefs, head chef Micha, and then we are 3 in the service section. So my sommelier, Johannes, me, and my restaurant chef, Jule. So most people we knew before, or we got some recommendations from other friends which are in the industry and recommending us good people, and we were talking to them, and they liked the idea, they liked the concept. They were seeing that this is not only serving food and drinks, that there is a little bit more at the end of the day.
Hmm. Yeah. And what is your background, or where were you before opening?
My background is that my grandparents had a restaurant, my parents had a restaurant, so I was born into
a restaurant. You had no choice.
No choice, exactly. So I was born into a restaurant somehow. So when I was young, went to school, when I came home after school, I was always having my dinners, my lunches in the restaurant, and normal people sitting around me.
Do they still exist?
No. They are older. They're retired so far.
Where were they in?
They were, the last 20 years, they were in Erlangen, near Nuremberg, which is in Bavaria, Franconia. Mm-hmm. And this was like a very good, basic restaurant. I wouldn't say family style, but a little bit more easy, but well cooked, all fresh products, very simple, but with an not local idea, but with a normal idea of producing German food at the time, which was like in the early 90s, early 2000s, I would say, and I was growing up in this restaurant, obviously, and I had no choice of working there, because I had to when my parents needed some help, then I needed to help them, obviously. And so at one point after school, I decided to do an apprenticeship in a restaurant, in a hotel, actually. And then I worked always in different restaurants afterwards, and at some point I realized that wine is an interesting focus. So I never went to sommelier school or anything. I think wine is something very practical. You have to drink it. You have to try a lot of things.
If one must.
Yes. Yeah, you have to try a lot of things. You know, theory is interesting, yes, but at the end all the theory doesn't mean anything or something. And I read about this one guy, he is a sommelier, and he never drank wine before because he's Muslim. I think it's crazy, you know, it's weird for me, because it's such a combination, I think, that you have to have the wine in your mouth. So I love that idea of drinking something, and I love the idea of different tastes. So at one point I became a sommelier, and in 2008 I came to Berlin, and I worked there for 6 years at Roots, which is a really nice wine bar, restaurant, Michelin star awarded, and so on. And at some point I thought, I'm working so many hours that I can do the hours for myself, so I can work so much for myself. And then I opened up the restaurant with help of Micha.
And what year was that? What year?
We opened up last year in 11th of February.
Okay.
So 2015.
Okay.
Then we opened up. And I got to know Misha in 2014, and we had about a year time to develop everything, and
And what's amazing about this is just the focus. You could pull from anywhere, but really Berlin, and sourcing from Berlin is your focus. How did you get to that point, or how did that kind of notion develop? With your chef?
At the end of the day, if you go to Sicily or if you go to south of France or to Catalonia, it's completely normal that these people who live there source their products from where they are living. The only thing that is really new, that a Nordic region, and we are in a Nordic region, I'm always saying we are more towards Scandinavia than we are to Italy,
mm-hmm.
because we don't grow wine here, mm-hmm. or don't grow grapes here. We grow grain, we do barley, we do beer, a lot of this. So we are in a very Nordic atmosphere, I think. And the only thing that is really new, that a Nordic country is, or a Nordic region, is being brave enough to look at their products, what they are having. So doing this allows us to know the people who are going to feed us, you know, who produce the food, which produce produce, which we like to, which we can develop, which we have the possibility of influencing the farmer, the producer with certain ideas. The farmer from Sicily, who should he care about a restaurant, or why should he care about a restaurant in Berlin? It's way too far away. There's no connection. And here in our region, there needs to be a connection between the farmer and the person and the chef. And Berlin is even something more special, because Berlin was separated for so long, and in the east there was this whole different style of producing food. It was mass production. It was the Planwirtschaft, where the communists said for over 5 years they had to produce this kind of amount of celery egg and tomatoes and potatoes and so on. So there was a complete different idea of how produce or products or connection between cooks and or chefs and farmers were connected. And we like to develop this somehow.
And so what have you learned from your local suppliers? Like, what have they taught you that might have been unexpected or kind of unknown as you went down this path?
We have to look up a word because I don't know it in English. Maybe one big thing is, you know, to be a farmer nowadays, it's for most people, it's not a really achievable job description, or not achievable way of living, you know, to become a doctor or a lawyer or working in a marketing agency or a communication agency or become something is somehow way more achievable for young people. And to become a farmer, it doesn't seem that this is has a lot of recognition in society somehow, that you're doing something really great. It's kind of funny because 200, 300, 400 years ago, it was a very respected job because everybody had to eat something, and the person who was producing the food was something very important. But nowadays, it's not more so important, it seems. So we learned from farming humility,
mm-hmm.
that this is a great, exhausting job. We learned how much work, how much effort it takes to produce something really great, and that every year is new because the season, the climate, the weather is changing so often. So there's not it's not always the same. There's always something crazy going on, it seems. And we learned that the farmer, at the end of the day, it's a farmer, and the farmer can be really happy that we are existing, because we try to tell him what are his really great advantages of, and that we're gonna put him in power, that he is doing something really great, and we are somehow fighting for that they get the right amount of money for their work, what they are doing. So, for instance, we never argue with the prices what a farmer is telling us. We don't want to push him down. To, you know, most of the time you go in a supermarket, you always see, you never see we have the best tomatoes or the best cherries or the best strawberries. We have the cheapest and right. And the cheapest doesn't always mean that somebody has to give away something from their salary, from their what they earn. So we somehow want to make the produce, the producer, the farmer much more important in our society. And this is what we learned, that this is very necessary, that we make him a person who's more special, because we need more crazy people who are doing great produce. There are farmers outside in the world. They do mass production and producing tons of vegetables and whatever, or tons of breeding chicken and so on and so on. This is, we don't talk about them. We talk about the individual person, the farm which is outside of Berlin, and focusing on only a couple of people, but on them they can focus in a really great, interesting way.
What's an example of crazy produce that you've discovered in your searches?
At the end, it's all things which is... No, crazy. For instance, eggs.
Okay.
Eggs is something really... You buy them without thinking. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, when you buy an egg, you know it's only female chicken. If a chicken gives birth to, like, if an chicken is growing up, what are you gonna do with the male chicken? You're gonna slaughter it, take it away, just destroy it. How do you feed the chicken? You're gonna give it some food that they produce a lot of eggs, and you're usually trying to keep them as little space as possible, and to be efficient in your way of producing egg, because you have a natural thing and you're trying to make it somehow straight and work, that you have the possibility of getting the most eggs as you want. So we are going a different way, and we are talking to Frau Schlegel. She is the person who's doing our eggs and who is doing our poultry, and we were trying to find a way that she can use everything what she's creating. So she's using the male chicken, she's using the female chicken. She's using no special feeding, that they produce a lot of eggs, you know? We want that the chicken run around, that they eat what the soil gives them, that they eat certain kind of grasses, that the egg at the end of the day, and that the chicken tastes at the end of the day different from summer to winter, because in summer they eat different things than they do in winter, and so on and so on. So we are somehow, it's sometimes the very easy things and the things where you say, oh, it's not special, an egg. But for us, an egg is really, really special, because we want to concentrate on the basic things and to produce them really, really right.
So one of the things that you also call out is that you have no use of pepper, citrus, et cetera, things that are non-native to Berlin. So
yes.
It's an interesting challenge. What have you used to replace it, or what is, you know, native to Berlin that comes in and uses for your seasoning of your dishes?
When a chef thinks of acidity, right, the first thing is what they think of is lemon, mm-hmm. because it's the most common thing to put acid in a dish. We don't use lemon, not because we don't like them. We love lemon, and it's a great product. But there is so much, more which has the advantage, or which has the which has the same possibility of souring things, and even making the taste a little bit different. If you work with verjus, which is ungripe grape juice, or when you sour with ronin berries, or when you sour with sea buckthorn, and or when you sour with whey, you can you have a certain acidity in your course as well, but it's slightly different because you it tastes a little bit different, and it's a little bit different haptic in your mouth, and this makes it interesting that your dishes taste at the end of the day a little bit different than what they normally taste. Because when you always put makeup on your food, which is seasoning at the end of the day, and it's always the same makeup, then it always looks and tastes the same. Hmm. So we are somehow working. So when we use spiciness or sharpness, like for instance pepper, we use a lot of the times we use mustard seeds. Mm-hmm. It is can be sharp and burning on your tongue as well, but it is a different burn. But we don't have pepper here, so by not using pepper and using mustard, we somehow create a certain taste which is more familiar to this region where we are living in than it's normally used. And this is what we want to do. We want to find out what kind of taste is Berlin, Germany capable of. If you think of a Sicilian course or Italian cuisine at the end of the day, you have a certain aromatic, a certain mindset in mind. Nobody hasn't done this for the region where we are living in. So, and we don't know what it will look like in 5 or 10 years when we have figure out everything, but now we are trying to figuring out what the region, what the taste of Berlin is like.
Well, now that you've been open for a year and a half,
yes,
and you have now been through a full growing season, are your producers producing stuff for you specifically? Do they now grow ingredients that they otherwise would not have grown before because the restaurant is pulling from the Berlin soil?
This is interesting. We opened up last year in February, and we worked with the products which were there. And we got in contact with certain farmers, and we figured out, okay, this farmer is better than that farmer. And it's not only because of farming, it's because of logistics and being reliable on certain things as well. Then at the end of the last year, we started to make plans for certain farmers, and we're trying to find out. They are planting certain products for us in certain quantities, in certain qualities, and we're getting from that farmer these kind of products, and some were really great, and some are not so good as the other one. So we are trying to get an idea which farmer has the good seeds, or which seeds work on the soil in a great way, or being in the climate really, really lovely. And this is the thing, that we need to do this because we need to find out who is best and what. In the wine world, it's completely normal. You would never go to Burgundy and would plant a Cabernet Sauvignon.
Right.
Because Chardonnay and Pinot Noir is, you know, that's the thing, what you're going to do. This is the best wines which work there, which we bring the best grapes and the best wine. So, but in the food way, you haven't been done this so far. You don't really know which area is really better than the other. You buy your rhubarb from somebody and you buy it and you like it or not. But there was no question about what kind of rhubarb they used, what kind of variety they used. Is the variety working on the soil what they are growing? And then it comes another point, that how they treat the variety in a certain region. You need to have some different treatments for different. So it's a huge spectrum, which is a year and a half. I think we have quite far already, but there's a lot of things to do to find out what what we are capable of. Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick musical break, mm-hmm. and then we're going to be right back and talk about the other side of this restaurant, the beverage program, mm-hmm. here on Snacky Tunes.
Check.
So, on the other side of the amazing food that you serve, your beverage program is really incredible, and it's also a really wonderful joy to read your menu because everything is written out so well and so thoughtful. So I want to kind of touch on four different areas about it, and I want to start with the water policy, because mm-hmm. I've definitely been to restaurants of this ilk, and you know, every bottle is, you know, all of a sudden you've got 100 euros added onto your bill, so... Explain to me how you arrived at your water policy and how you kind of picked that type of service.
At the end, I thought I'm kind of really lazy in carrying water from the cellar up to the restaurant and empty bottles down to the cellar. And then the new delivery once a week usually comes and you're going to bring it up to the person who... delivers the water, and then you're going to bring the new bottles down to the cellar, and this whole thing is so much work that it is so unnecessary work, I think, that I said, we're going to skip this. And obviously, at the same time, it's a very psychological friendliness to the customer if you don't charge for the water. Obviously, we have a little... We charge 80 euro for the water... For the menu, sorry. And
it all comes out.
Yes. We charge 80 euro for the food. And we have a small percentage of 5 euro where we say, this is for our water in calculation and so on. But at the end of the day, people can drink so much as they want, which is very necessary. And if they drink more water, they drink more wine, or they tolerate the alcohol, which they should drink, much better.
Mm.
And this is what we want, that people spend their money on wine, and spending a lot of money on wine, and obviously wine has alcohol, and they shouldn't feel bad doing it. So physically, and obviously psychologically as well. And if you drink 3 bottles of water right next to 5 glasses of wine, you feel much better than you would if you would not do it, you know? And we are a restaurant, even if you're sitting here and you've completely done, and we try to keep your water glass as full as possible. Mm. We filter the water. It's a Brita filter. We ionize the water with Aqua Blue. So we try to get great, soft, very energetic, slowed down water. You have to imagine, water in our Western Hemisphere is always running through pipes, and it's coming from one place, going to other place. It's never standing.
Mm.
And when you look at the molecules of water, when the water is standing, it's different, and then it tastes different, quite different. We in Berlin have a very strong mineral water, so our water seems here in the restaurant more soft, more lighter from the texture. And that's the whole thing, why we do the water for free, and that what we want with it. But at the end of the day, it's about my laziness, carrying the bottles from cellar to restaurant and from restaurant to cellar, and so on and so on.
So kind of up next is beer, and obviously beer is so important in Germany. What role does beer play in this restaurant? You know, you would think that this is mostly wine, but you have such a great kind of background, and you have a no craft beer policy. How does that fit into the mentality?
Germany has a very big culture when it comes to beer, but most of the time it is... it's regional beer, which means, you know, if you are growing up in Bavaria, if you're growing up in Franconia, you're going to drink your beer, and you're going to drink it all life long. So it's like being a fan of Bayern Munich. You will never change. You will never be going to a different soccer club. You will never do this. And it's the same with the beer. If you have your first alcoholic experience as somebody who is 14, 15, 16 years old, you're going to have that with that kind of beer, you're going to stick with this probably all life long. In the last couple of years, there was a little change in this, that beer got more diverse, and that there are a lot of new interesting tastes and beer styles coming into Germany, and that this whole craft beer movement arrived in Germany, and people starting to drink ales, pale ales, IPAs, stouts, all these kind of different things. We have in Berlin, we have a huge community right now of small brewers, which do great different styles than only Helles and Pils and wheat beer, because these are the three styles which I would say 95% of all Germans drink. You maybe have some exceptions if you are in Cologne, people are going to drink Kölsch, or when people coming from Düsseldorf, they're going to drink Altbier. But at the end of the day, it's mostly that most people drink Pilsner, Helles, or wheat beer. So being in Germany and beer is so important, with one of the hugest amounts of breweries in the world, but brewing only at the end of the day maybe 5 or 6 different beer types for the German market, then it is kind of crazy that we shouldn't concentrate on beer. We have to concentrate on beer and show the diversity of German beer at the one side, but also showing the beer diversity in general, what beer can mean. And obviously beer has different tastes, and with different tastes you can accompany different foods in a really interesting way, which we like to do as well. So when people ordering a beverage pairing, we also call it beverage pairing, not wine pairing, then we also serve one or two beers with it normally. Because for a lot of dishes, wine doesn't make so much sense than serving a beer. And beer allows you to have a huge range of different tastes and different styles that you can combine food and beer in a different way than you would do it with a normal white wine or a normal red wine.
One of my favorite reads in the whole menu book, which I recommend anyone listening after this to go and read your beverage menu, is the schnapps section. Mm-hmm. While all the other sections kind of read a little bit like educational, this almost reads like a speech bordering on a rant, including such lines like, it's a farce, and a rally against bartenders as ambassadors. So while asking you now, what is your feeling on the current state of schnapps, and how do you battle against that in what you serve in your restaurant?
We have, you know, we have this huge bar scene in Germany, which I would say started like really going straight like maybe 10, 15 years ago. And it was all about bourbon, whiskey. It was all about vodka. We have this huge gin hype in Germany where you have restaurants, where you have bars where they offer like 100 of different gins and so on. And when you look at the companies who are really producing these, it's only actually a few. So they make up all these different brands and these different marketing ideas, and some agencies doing a really nice story around a product. And at the end of the day, it's all somehow, it seems that it's all kind of marketing. Then when you talk to bartenders, where they get their knowledge from, it's always really difficult because they get their knowledge from the industry. And the industry is putting out the certain curriculums, how they teach people, what they're going to tell, that they're going to know how the product is really produced in an exact way. And we were questioning this because really there isn't much people working with German schnapps, with German fruit schnapps. Because when I started to work in the restaurant business, you were drinking a certain time, you were drinking after meal, the German fruit schnapps. So we have fruits which are somehow preserved in alcohol and then distilled, and then or the fruit is made into, or is changed into alcohol, or processed into alcohol, and then you're going to have a schnapps from it, which is a German, huge German heritage, I would say. You're going to find this in Switzerland and in Austria and Italy and France as well, but in the south of Germany, it's quite common to do this. So, and we were thinking that nobody's really taking care of this topic, and this is such an important topic. And when you talk to these schnapps producers, you feel right away that they are doing really handcrafted things. And when you ask them, have you ever visited big alcohol producing companies produce bourbon and stuff like this, I said, oh yeah, come on, you know, they are tricking here, they are trying to do their certain things, and it's industry made, you know. And most of them are doing a really interesting handmade product which is not so recognized as something really cool, an achievement or achievable, and we wanted to focus on that. So
what are some of the brands or some of the types that you serve here?
We have, you know, like we have wines from certain growers and not companies, we have schnapps from no companies, from growers. So most of them they grow their vegetable, their fruit by themselves, or they buy it from people who are living in the region and buying certain produce and making out of the produce a schnapps. So, for instance, one of our most important one is Christoph Keller from the Sterlemühle. He's the guy who he was behind Monkeys 47, which is a very influential gin. Rudolf Schwarzer from Austria is a very important one. Josef Fahrthofer is a very important one. Fridolin Baumgartner is a very important one. So they all do something which is in our mindset very important. 200-300 years ago, you had so much fruit to a certain time that you need to preserve it in some way. In some way, you made juice out of it. In some way, you made marmalade out of it. In some way, you're gonna preserve it, pickle it, whatever you did. And in some way, you did some schnapps out of it. And from that history, it's something really important what we trying to tell people, you know? And these drinks are very, these beverages are very German. So people from other states, they don't usually know these kind of schnapses so well. They have not seen them so often because the whole world is focused on whiskey. And people paying hundreds of euro for a whiskey, but if you're going to produce a fruit schnapps, they say, wow, okay, come on, lad. Why is that so expensive, you know?
So the last kind of part of the beverage program I'm going to focus on is wine and your philosophy behind kind of like the fermented fruit wine. Mm-hmm. You talk about, you know, fermented cherries is not considered a wine, but I think you presuppose that, you know, it is.
In the German law. In German law. It's not.
And most people probably argue along the same lines, but you talk about the Werderblossom Festival from 1879 as a starting point. Can you give some context around the festival and you know, your philosophy of looking outside the grape?
And being in a, you know, humans always wanted to have or needed alcohol because alcohol was at a certain time age, it was the only thing that was really clear and what was clean at the end of the day. So with alcohol, people could drink something. And the water issue being rotten was something really difficult, I would say. And being in that region where we live in, where we don't grow grapes, where we don't have wine because wine is not getting ripe enough, the fruit wine thing is something really interesting that you have the possibility of a person who's producing cherries, plums, red currant, rhubarb, all kinds of different fruits, getting really crazy about the quality of the fruit and to produce then or to process the fruit into a different drink. And when they do this, they're going to help somehow the region with a certain idea that farming makes much more sense if you process the fruit to a different drink than only producing the fruit and then selling the fruit, because people are somehow paying way more for a processed fruit than only for the fruit. Mm. The fruit itself has a certain price, and people would never pay 100 euro for a kilo of grapes or cherries. But for a bottle of wine, 50 euro is not something really crazy. Mm. So farming nowadays makes not really, is a really hard job, and it's really hard that people earn the right amount of money. And being in our region where we are, this can be a really big advantage because we have so much cherries, we have so much apples around Berlin, that we have to process these things into a different stage and do it with the same quality idea than we would use grapes. So for us, working local and trying to somehow change the perception is that we're trying to change the perception from customers, which means usually when they see fruit wine, they say, oh, it's much more easy and much more cheap than a normal wine. But we say, no, that's not true. A wine, a beer, a fruit wine can be on the same level of intensity, of quality-wise, which we like to... which is for us very important that people understand that this is the same quality issue, you know, and that you can produce a great beverage out of everything if you do it really right. And nobody hasn't done it so far in a really same matter here in the region of Berlin. Outside of Berlin, from Denmark, from Brittany, from Italy, you're going to find here and there some single products. But we are in Germany, not so far yet, that we're going to produce great products from other alcoholic drinks besides wine.
Is there one purveyor that you think is exemplary of it? And what is the base fruit of their fruit wine?
Here in Germany?
No, just in any of the regions.
What is purveyor?
The supplier.
Yes. I love, and I think it's very important, you know, we have two suppliers which we work really close from Denmark. The one is from Lolland. It's Frederiksdal. It's a cherry wine producer, which had problems. They have like about 42 hectares of cherries, and the cherry price went really down, and because nobody really wanted to pay so much money for the cherries, so they had to either they take the cherries away, destroy them, and plant something what they get money for, or they're going to process the cherries somehow into a cherry wine and to get the money what they need for their processing and for their fruit production. And the other one is Cold End Winery, another one from Denmark, and they are great, and they make a great rhubarb wine and a great red currant wine, and they do some sweet... apple ice wine, and this is great products which you don't see so often. They are pricey, but not pricier than a bottle of wine. They are pricey for their range, what they usually produced, but for a wine, paying 15-20 euro for a bottle is nothing, something crazy, but for a rhubarb wine, it's unbelievable much to produce that amount, to pay that amount of money for it. But it shows perfectly that these kind of business can work quite a lot.
Well, I want to thank you for making time for me today.
Thank you.
Where can people find you? How can they make reservations? How can they get a hold of you?
They should check the internet on www.nobelhartundschmutzig.com. And then obviously we are working with social media quite well, so we're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And when they want to do a reservation, they check our homepage. There they have the possibility of, and or they give us a call.
And you're closing for a bit this summer, right?
We are trying to close as much as possible in the year. because being creative means that you need some time for yourself as well. So we are closing about for 4 weeks from mid-August to mid-September. And we are always trying to close for about 2 to 3 weeks in January.
Okay.
So beginning of January.
So make sure you check. We're going to take a quick musical break, and then we'll be back with the second part of Snacky Tunes.
A long time ago, when we were in school, you used to laugh at me, call me a fool. How my dream of the day that you would change your tune. I never thought that day would come so soon. You went from name calling to calling my name. You went from schoolyard teasing to all night pleasing. Used to be so much trouble, now your love is doubled. Things will never be the same since you went from name calling to calling my name. Alright. It all started that day after summer vacation. I knew I had changed your heart's education. Oh, don't know what I did. change your mind. Must have been something within you. All the time you went from name calling to calling my name. You went from school to teasing to all night pleasing. Used to be so much trouble. Now you're with me on the double. Things will never be the same since you went from name calling to calling my name. Now instead of fussing and fighting, we're making sweet romance and love letter writing. Like the old saying goes, and girl, you must take heed. I may not be what you want, but I'm what you need. Sticks and stones might hurt me. Words can't do no harm. Now instead of running from you, I'm running to your arms. You went from name calling to calling my name. You went from schoolyard teasing to all night pleasing. Used to be so much trouble. Now you're with me on the double. Things will never be the same. Never be the same. Never be the same. No more schoolyard games. Never be the same. Never be the same. So you went from name calling to calling my name.
Have you tasted the world's best cheese? Grand Cru Sirchois is the 2016 World Cheese Champion. Our partners at Roth, Wisconsin make this gorgeous alpine-style cheese in the rolling hills of Greene County, Wisconsin. Grand Cru Sirchois is produced by hand in Swiss copper vats and finished by aging on spruce planks. The quality milk and careful craftsmanship bring out the award-winning light floral notes, nutty undertones, a hint of fruitiness, and a mellow finish. Perfect with Riesling and Muscat, Grand Cru Sirchois is a guaranteed hit for any occasion. Check out their other offerings at rothcheese.com. You'll discover Buttermilk Blue and their newest release, Prairie Sunset, the golden-hued love child of Mimolette and Gouda. You'll also find recipes like the Raclette Reuben and tomato tartlets. Everything you need to know about the world's best cheese is at rothcheese.com.
Welcome, Moon Hooch.
Yeah.
Hey.
You guys can move a little bit closer to the mic.
I have to say that you are my favorite buskers, and
thank you.
Hold on, let's step back. So we
I can't start with compliments.
Well, no, you can start with compliments, but Darren and I were, you know, we live off the L train, and I transfer at 14th Square, and like, I saw you guys play, and I was like, man, like, I see a lot of buskers, but, like, what are these guys doing down here? Like, this doesn't make any sense. They're a little bit too, you know, they're not playing a pan flute, and, like, I really felt that you guys should be, like, above ground. And then we started talking. I was like, dude, I saw this band. He's like, was it Moon Hooch? I was like, yeah, it was totally those guys. So eventually we were like, we got to just get these guys on the show. And then I saw you play, like, a few weeks ago on a Friday night. I was coming back from dinner, and it was a literal just dance party. At 14th Square, people were just skipping their trains just to dance. First off, how often does that happen?
Every weekend if we play there. But we don't play every weekend, so it's kind of irregular.
Yeah, recently we've been playing at Union, actually Washington Square Park, under the arch.
Who do I have to go beat up if they like move you away from my train stop?
Well, it did happen already. The police has been cracking down all the buskers at 14th Street Union Square.
They're trying to stop.
Yeah, so lately every time we played there we were stopped by the police.
So let's step back. How do you become a busker in New York, and like, is it official, is it a schedule?
Well, the way we do it is very unofficial. We just set up wherever and play. It's totally illegal.
Oh really?
Yeah
I mean, there is like a program called Music Under New York, and that gives you like a permit to play. But you can't play on the subways, on the platforms. You can only play in the mezzanines.
Okay.
But the problem with this is the judges of the program are musicians themselves, subway musicians themselves, so they give themselves the permit. And we applied for it. We didn't get one. We didn't get a permit. So
is there a code of, like, is there a code? Because I feel that I saw you guys play there on, like, somewhat regular, basis. Like, is there a code, like, hey man, we were here first, or it's like,
oh, like yeah, the other buskers?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's first come, first serve, really.
Well, and, yeah, it was really hard for us to like get accepted by the other buskers, because yeah, some of them do this for like 10 years.
Right.
And like, I mean, there was definitely a couple of occasions where we almost got in fist fights.
Yeah. Really?
Well, James, I mean, James.
Well, we'll leave that story for off air. But so what is the, I mean, what is the history of you guys? Like, how did you form and how did you decide to go underground? Like, literally.
Well, we all went to the new school.
Okay.
For music together. And James and I were friends, but once in a while, I kind of knew each other.
Wait, take it around the room, because we didn't make an
entrance. Oh, yeah. James is the...
Hello.
He's the distant voice in the back.
Just the drummer.
I don't have a microphone.
Oh, no, it sounds good. It sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good?
Yeah, it's good.
It's picking up.
Yeah.
Right. And so James, I'm Mike.
Okay.
Saxophone.
I'm Wenzel.
Yeah. Other saxophone. Other saxophone.
Yeah. And we went to school together, and James and I were playing you know, separately, and Wenzel was playing with James, and we were both kind of going down to the subway, but on like in separate groups, you know, just separate duos. And then one day we met in Washington Square, and James and Wenzel were playing Under the Arch, and I was with another drummer named Max, and we decided to play together, and a huge crowd formed around us, and we were playing like house, kind of like housey dance music, because Wenzel has been producing it. And you know, he said like, oh, I'll play in this key, something like that, and came up with a melody over it, and you know, we got a really good crowd reaction, so we decided to keep going with it.
Yeah, I started just writing in the subway, on the subway rides to the platform, just little melodies and bass lines, just like I would do when I produce like an electronic song, like that kind of style, and showed it to Mike, and we just quickly learned it by heart and started playing. In the beginning, we only had like one or two songs, and like we just all night we're just looping the same song.
it kept drunk people dancing. Though.
Yeah, but I mean, if it's a subway platform, like you really probably like need like what, maybe like 22 minutes if it's late at night because the train's going.
Yeah, even less. I mean, 20. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I'm being generous.
Yeah, yeah. Like, but yeah, now we have like a full like, I don't know, 2 hour set. With, like,
I mean, you have a full record.
20. Yeah, yeah. We have another one ready, but we. We're going to work on it some more before we go in the studio.
And before we get into a song, where did the name come from?
Mike just blurted out one day. We were playing, we had no name, we weren't even considering ourselves a band, we were just all making money in the subway. And somebody asked us, hey, well, what's our name? And Mike just was in a goofy mood and said, Moon Juice. And we said, oh, actually, that sounds like a cool name. And then we looked it up, and there were 8 bands called Moon Juice.
Of course.
And
obviously.
Then we went through the thesaurus and we found a replacement for Juice.
I mean, it is.
And then Hooch, and then it made sense. Like, oh, it's like moonshine.
Yeah. No, it's good. Yeah. Let's get into a song.
Yeah.
All
right. Let's do a song. Which one are you guys going to play first?
Number 7, this one's called. Or Take the L Train.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nice. I get the reference.
live on Snacky Tunes, Moon Hooch. It's about to get loud. I think that is the loudest that it's been in here.
No.
No?
Immaculate.
Oh, Immaculate. Yeah, I guess they had amps. But, all right, second loudest.
So dancey.
Yeah, so dancey. I mean, so how much of does your electronic house music background come to influence in writing your songs now?
A fair amount, actually. We all started listening to electronic music. I started listening to electronic music probably about 2 years ago. Wenzel's been doing it for, like, maybe 5 years. Mike, about the same
age. Have you? 2 years. 5 years?
What? Listening or producing?
Listening.
I've been listening to
it. I got really into electronic music when I started producing it. Like, that's, I think, when I got...
When was that?
I don't know. When was it? Like, 2008 or 7. 2008 or 9.
Cruise ship?
Yeah, I was working on a cruise ship, and I...
That's like 2009.
Yeah.
What were you doing? You're just going to drop that in there? Like, it's a comment. What were you doing on a cruise ship?
Well, I was actually working there as a saxophone player and flautist and clarinetist.
Oh, okay.
But my passion was not really the music we played there. It was just more like work, and I got to know the DJ of the cruise, and we just like started producing together.
Amazing. Yeah. So how did you go from busking to gigs, or were you also pursuing gigs like in clubs along the same time?
I think it's just that people see us on the train and literally drop their card or take our card or, you know, get in touch with us. And now we have a manager, so thanks so much.
By the way, thank you, Rich. He got back to me immediately.
Signed yeah, Richard's the man. Yeah, he's nailing it.
Yeah, it's much easier now.
Yeah.
I can imagine. So, what was your first gig outside of busking together?
As first ever?
I remember it. You know where it was?
I was on the
rooftop of... What's her name? The red-haired girl.
Oh, that's right. Randall Wendell. Oh,
yeah. Randall Wendell, yeah.
Holy shit. Was that the first ever?
That was our first gig. I remember
in Williamsburg,
exactly,
that's right.
Yeah, because we never played a gig before, and we were like really worried we're going to run out of songs and whatnot, or people are not going to like it. I
you can't do
exactly
the like repeat trick like you do in
right.
the subway.
Yeah, exactly. but it was really cool. Actually, people started dancing so hard, the roof almost collapsed.
Yeah,
but that was not because people danced, it was the roof was shitty.
Yeah, okay.
it was definitely quite an experience.
And then, so you guys formed when exactly?
Summer of 2010.
Okay. Oh, so not that long ago.
No, we're newborns.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Not even 2 years. Yeah.
So, like, just to go back to the subway, because it's such an interesting thing. We don't get to talk to too many buskers. Like, what was it like that you had to do to get accepted by the other buskers? And like, what were some of the trappings?
You know, they used to come at us, like, we play, and, like, a bucket drummer came, sat up next to us, and started playing a different tempo.
And yeah, they were, like, real rude about it. Like, super aggressive.
Yeah, super sandbag.
So really aggressive.
That's aggressive, right? It's not passive aggressive.
And then, like, we said something like, what do you want to play together? Or, like, do you want to... Just wouldn't respond. I'm doing this for 10 years. 10 years. Do you see the marks here? That's because I've made them. I've been here for 10 years.
Oh, the marks as the people watch.
Yeah, and, you know... Yeah, it got really heated, the situation, and we left.
We ended up just leaving. Whatever, man, you can have
you
it.
Know, just, the, we're not going to fight you over this. We go through the situation over and over again, and then the other buskers actually listen to you, and then they actually, you know, we start liking each other, and now I feel like the other buskers are our friends, and we say, hey, I'm going to come back in 1 hour, are you going to be still playing? Oh, yeah, you know, it's more...
Yeah, we kind of just schedule it, you know, whoever's there first, like, and then we're like, yeah, so we'll be here until 10, you know, you can have it then.
Huh.
And
but so like all the people on like Bedford and everything, like that's also illegal as well.
Everything
is legal.
Well, what about those people in with the signs?
Well, you said that's part of the alliance, right?
Wait,
it's on the mezzanine
with the music on the New York signs.
Yeah,
that's legal.
So what are the cops? Do they come and they're like, you guys can't be here?
It depends on the cop. Sometimes the cops like our music and they just let us keep going. But sometimes they like they'll yell at us, and be like, this isn't a club.
That's so I mean, I feel like... Yeah, I mean, I guess...
Oh, really?
So.
The thing is that it's not, like, a strict law. It's kind of, like,
ambiguous.
Area,
ambiguous, you know? Yeah, because we don't have amplification.
Right, that's the one thing I know. It's, like, no electricity,
right.
But you guys are loud as shit.
Yeah,
so,
we're loud.
Like,
yeah.
The guy with the pan flute is definitely not gonna start
He's got amplification.
Actually,
he does, yeah.
If
yeah,
you look
does.
At the one guy we saw, his pan flute's still attached to a microphone that he used to play off of, which is kind of sad, because it's, like... A yes, your thing, and you're not really going to hear the theme to Titanic the same way without the backing tracks. So,
yeah.
You guys are loud, so I can see how like they would be like, well, that's kind of
yeah,
not,
totally.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, cops walk by and say, I can't even hear myself thinking. Stop. You know?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, totally makes sense. Just
so, do you see, you know, as things progress, you know, leaving the subway and just playing more and more shows, and like, was this a stepping stone? Totally. Or
I mean, well, we have a residency right now.
How did the residency? It's at Knitting Factory.
Yeah.
Right.
How did that come about?
Well, I got in touch with them last year because we were doing warehouse parties, and those became too dangerous, too illegal,
too much,
and too big, and we didn't want to have the responsibility anymore. So we want to contact clubs to play in clubs. And after, you know, talking a little bit to the Knitting Factory, they finally booked us, and the bartender and intern, who was Richard, figured out that we didn't have a manager, and he always wanted to be a manager, and he's really talented as a manager.
Wait, so what?
Sorry, I'm talking about...
No, I get it. So Richard was a bartender at
Knitting Factory. And the book, he did booking.
And he did booking.
And then he got us the residency.
And he's still working over there?
Yeah,
he still works there, too.
So, pretty good, right?
Pretty good. Yeah,
pretty
it's great. Good.
Extra drink tickets, right? Huh? Extra drink tickets?
Well, we got a bottle of Jameson in the green room.
Hey, we have the same writer. Same writer. Well,
let's look at that song.
Wait a second. How does the fee get negotiated? Does he just kind of, like, look in a mirror and be like, I don't know, man, it seems a little high. It's like, well, you know, they're a good band. They've been working hard.
No, he's not the manager at the Knitting Factory, so he has to negotiate with the manager at the Knitting Factory.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, yeah, let's rip another tune. I think we can actually say rip another tune for this band.
Song from Miguel?
Yeah, that's why I've been saying it.
Yeah, let's do it.
This next one is called Song from Miguel. Miguel's a guy, really awesome man, who gave us our saxophones, actually.
He gave them to you?
Yeah, all of them. So,
what?
He's a man. Yeah, and they're like the best saxophones you can get.
Yeah.
So, thank you, Miguel. Always.
Yeah. Thank you.
Barn burner.
Are they getting pissed off out there?
I think they're getting a little... I think it's a little loud. It's fine. I think we'll maybe just keep it at those two songs and we'll just kind of take it out.
Cool.
Wait, can you go back to that story about getting the saxophones?
Yeah. When I was living in Portugal...
By the way, that sounded awesome. Yeah, that sounded really good. I just want to say that even though they went around and asked, everyone was like, no, we're totally cool with the music.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay, so you're in...
I was living in Portugal in 2007, and I literally received a phone call from somebody I didn't know, and he asked me, give me your address, and I said, why? And he's like, I'm in a divine mission, and you're the chosen. And, like, wow. I gave him my address, and a week later, this fucking crazy saxophone arrived. It's a Con that's 60 years old. It's, like, a really rare saxophone that all the, like, famous saxophone players played on. And then I came to New York, and I actually got to meet the guy that gave me the saxophone.
Mm-hmm. Wait, how did he hear about you, though?
I played a jazz festival in Portugal, and a friend of his saw me and told him about me. And then I got to meet Miguel finally in New York, and he's like a really cool guy. He's a saxophone player himself, who got a lot of money by doing a translation company, and he's the most generous, amazing guy. And I just mentioned, like, I just asked him, like, what kind of brand of baritone saxophone should I get? I'm like thinking about buying a cheap one, and he's like, oh, you want a Barry? And I'm like, yeah, I have a Mark VI. Those are $12,000. They cost $12,000. There's this one right here.
It's like the best one.
He's like, yeah, yeah, I have it in Valencia right now. I get it to you by the end of the month. And he did. And then we played a party at his house, and he took... Well, Mike, do you want to tell that story?
Yeah, so we're playing... So we played a party at Miguel's house on his roof. And, you know, just having a good time. And then after we played, he's like, hey, Mike, I just bought a Sonny Stitt's horn off eBay.
Sonny Stitt's a really famous saxophone player.
Yeah. Like from way back. He's like, you want to check it out? I said, yeah, obviously. So I go down, and he's like, why don't you play it? If you fall in love with it, you can have it. It's like, oh my god. Okay.
So, who is this guy?
Jesus.
A good man.
He's the saxophone Jesus. But, yeah, so we went to his room, and like a bunch of people came, and I played it, and I loved it. You know, it was just like the best one I ever played. And, gave it to me that night. It was a trip. It was pretty weird.
Yeah. That was crazy.
The look on your face was amazing.
Mike started crying, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I cried a little bit.
Yeah, I would cry too. I would have cried too. That's amazing. And it also, you know, shaped 2/3 of the band.
Yeah.
And the sound, like...
It's all... I mean, vintage saxophones that we could never afford.
Mine went from 1941.
Yeah.
And it's all coming from these two. Like, you couldn't recreate this with cheaper horns.
No, you could, but not
the same quality.
I mean, you can't.
Yeah.
Replace a Mark VI. You know, you can't replace a Con.
Yeah.
It's
amazing. So, you know, why don't you guys tell us about? You know, you have a show coming up in April, right?
Yeah, April 13th.
Knitting Factory.
Yeah.
Is it just you guys, or is anybody else playing?
It's just us, and it starts at 12 a.m. So.
Midnight.
Oh, amazing. And then
so wait, is that the Thursday night or the Friday night?
Yeah, that's the confusion. Friday it's Friday night.
Okay,
yeah,
you can buy tickets online at Ticketfly.
I usually just try and tell people it starts at 11:59 on Friday night.
Yeah, right. I know 11:59.
Because then
otherwise gets confusing. Yeah, 11:59.
And then they don't
Friday
miss,
night.
11:59, 59 seconds. You know,
yeah,
might be
59
second
seconds exactly.
Yeah, we take this age. And then you guys have one record out already.
Yeah.
Where can you get that?
Yeah. You can get it on Bandcamp.
Yeah.
On iTunes, you can get it on
Amazon. Anything that you can buy CDs on.
Spotify, anything really.
Amazing. And then you said you have another record coming out.
Well, it's not coming out, it's just being produced right now by us.
We have about probably 23, 24 songs.
Yeah, we have
songs.
Another 12 songs.
Amazing.
But what we want to do for our next album, this album is totally acoustic everything, and for the next album we want to elaborate on the sound a little bit, you know? Like,
we want to start incorporating electronic effects.
Or we've been also going to junkyards collecting metal, and, you know, we're planning on building percussion racks, and, I don't know, we maybe even incorporate, like, some rhythmic samples of a subway train, going through the tunnel in Bedford, you know?
Cut it up,
make a drum set out of it. Just, like, we want to experiment a lot with it and surprise our fans with our next
album.
That's
awesome. Bigger band?
Yeah, well, we're expanding the band.
We're gonna have some guests. We're gonna have a rapper. We're gonna have a singer that we're actually working on with right now already, and we're also gonna invite five saxophone players for one song or two.
Amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
All right. So, why don't you give the nuts and bolts of where to find you guys online, Twitter, email, bookings, all that stuff.
Yeah. You can see us online. Facebook Moon Hooch or Twitter Moon Hooch, moonhooch.com. Or moonhooch.bandcamp.com. Just Google us. We're on YouTube.
Yeah, awesome. It shouldn't be hard to find us.
Yeah.
Awesome. So I think we're going to have to call it today.
Yeah.
This is the first time that's actually two of the owners are sitting out there of all the times that have come to play.
We'll do one more.
Is Roberta out there?
We're good on one more, guys.
Oh, we are good on one more?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Great. All right. So on the show. So thank you to everybody who was on the show today. Thank you for the fried chicken sandwiches from Smith Canteen, Searsucker. Are you going to be here next week?
No, I'll actually be gone for the next few weeks. Next week, Jack, you'll be happy about this. It's a DJ set. Lemonade, our good friends Lemonade are going to come back. They're going to play a DJ set, talk about the new record they have coming out in May. And then, we'll be back with some more episodes of Snackin' Tunes. And I'll be back in a few weeks.
Sweet.
Okay.
Well,
okay.
You going to be okay?
I guess.
I'll hug you after this.
All right.
Okay.
I didn't know you were going to be missing so many weeks.
Surprise.
Awesome.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay. Well, I'll be here.
For this next one, we're going to...
What is that?
Wenzel's sticking a cardboard tube in his saxophone, in the bell of the saxophone, to lower the pitch of the horn.
Yeah,
so
it makes the lowest note, a minor six lower.
And we're going to try and emulate some dubstep.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, here we go.
So sorry, owners of...
No, it's fine. Hey, they gave us the sign-off. Moon Hooch on Snacky Tunes. I'll see you next week. Greg will not. Have fun at Coachella.
I'll try.
Okay, bye. We'll be right back.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.